Hello, and welcome to episode 145 of Ribbon of Memes, a podcast where we interrogate films previously described by other liberal Europeans as... I'm sorry, that's an allusion to the type of film we've watched. As masterpieces, I am joined, as ever, by Roger, Hello. Stalwart Watcher. Hello, and I'm delighted to be joined once again by Marianne Johansson, the philosopher of film.
Hello, I'm back.
Hello.
Nice to be back. Thank you.
It's lovely to have you back.
Thank you.
And we thought we'd watch something terribly clever for this episode.
Well, we didn't look like... sometimes feel as if we started off with these grand intentions of watching these great important films, and then I proposed Ghosts of Mars. And
well, then we watched the entire of John Carpenter's oeuvre, which I'm not complaining about.
Yeah, but most of it.
Yeah, we're working on it.
There's some good films in there.
Definitely.
I mean, there's a lot of good films, yeah.
I mean, I'm not disappointed by doing any of that, but we thought we'd try and go back to the original idea of films that are masterpieces that we probably wouldn't have otherwise watched. And I think, despite you being incredibly prolific film watcher, this is a trilogy that we're going to discuss that you haven't watched previously, Marianne? Is that
right? Yeah, that's right. I'd never seen these before. I was aware of them, and sort of they were in the back of my head as films I should get around to. But yeah, I probably wouldn't have gotten to them quite so soon if not for your very kind invitation to come on and talk about them.
Well, let's see what we thought about that. And what we are talking about is the Three Colors trilogy, the Trois Couleurs. This is the one and only time I'm going to attempt French. Yeah, Trois Couleurs Bleu, Blanc, et Rouge, named after the three colors of the French flag by a Polish director, of course.
Yeah, Krzysztof Kielowski, who did say in an interview...
I love the way you just toss off that pronunciation.
Very impressive.
Been practicing mine all evening.
He said he took the theme Liberté, Égalité, Fraternité because the money was French, and if it had been a different funding country, they would have called them something else, but probably the films would have been the same. So
I think it's fair to say they're... So the films are supposed to be based on Liberté for blue... Equality for white and fraternity for red. I'd fair to say they're quite loose.
I would say it's a bit of a stretch. I was trying to figure out how these things fit into the films. I mean, there's various arguments you can make, but it's not overly obvious. Which maybe that's a good thing.
Yeah, I would have picked it up without the cues.
No. But as you say, what we have basically is three... I wouldn't even say loosely connected, short stories in a way, along a similar sort of...
Yeah, they have a little bit of crossover, but I don't think it would be fair to call it a trilogy in the conventional sense. I mean, this is certainly not one big story.
No. Right, agreed, yeah. There are... By the time the end of the final film came around, they turn out to be a bit more connected, perhaps, than...
Yeah.
They seem at first, and I feel like, so I only was able to watch them once. I feel like I would want to watch them again, and I'm sure there's things that I've missed.
Some of them, definitely. I wouldn't necessarily say them all. Should we take them in order then? Blue, so that you can watch them in any order, they're that loosely connected, but I watched them in the order they were made, and it's just, which is blue, white, red.
Yeah.
So I guess we'll take them in that order. Trois Couleurs, I said I wasn't going to do that again. Three Colors Blue, as I'm going to refer to it from now on. So this is Juliette Binoche.
Returning to Ribbon of Memes from The English Patient, which you'd make 2 years after this.
Oh, yeah, The English Patient. Yeah, we weren't... well, listen to that and see what we thought of it. It was okay.
Well, but whatever complaints we may have had about it, they weren't about Juliette Binoche. So.
No, and she is a goddess.
She's in, whatever else to say about the film, I mean, I think she is standout the best actor of all three films, I would say, personally.
I think the first film is the best of the three.
Yes, I agree. I've been pondering it a bit. It was pretty easy to eliminate one of them, personally, but I do think Blue is the most moving of them.
Yeah.
I mean, the films have been described by... Roger Ebert, as an anti-tragedy, this one, an anti-comedy, white, and an anti-romance, red. I don't know if this is an anti-blue. I mean, I suppose an anti-tragedy in that sort of follows the reverse trajectory in that we start with a car crash. Spoilers for all three films will abound, as typical.
Inevitable.
We start with a car crash that wipes out Julie's husband and her 7-year-old daughter. Certainly
she,
young.
I think she's daughter. 5, yeah.
5-year-old daughter.
She's very young.
That's how the film starts. And it, I mean, it's not, there is no way gratuitous. It's well, by well done. You know, there's no blood, there's no, we just see this horrific accident. And then we find Julie waking up in the hospital.
And this was the point at which the film won me over, frankly. Not so much the accident, though that was pretty good, but the whole sequence in the hospital where, you know, obviously the audience has to be cued in, you know, who is this person, what has she just lost, and so on. And it's done entirely diegetically. So somebody brings in a portable TV so she can watch her husband's funeral.
Her own husband's funeral, yeah.
And then I like how it's a really slow reveal about who she is and what's happened and why it is, of how it's going to affect everybody else in the film. And, it's the way that we learn who her husband was, and it just absolutely, it's like this slow unpeeling of, I don't know, or an unfurling of a flower or something. I think it's really amazingly done.
It is, because you're gripped kind of right from the start, but you want to know more, and it just,
so you're like,
does
why
it.
Is her husband's funeral on TV?
Yeah, why?
The first thing I thought was, because she's still in the hospital, somebody just went there and was recording it so she could be there. But then you realize, no, there's photographers everywhere.
I thought it was some sort of live stream, and then I thought, oh, wait, no, this is a 90s film. So, probably not.
That was my initial first thought, too, sort of like a 90s version of a live stream. Mm. Something just private for her, but no, it's clear that's not the case.
And then we're introduced to the character of Julie, and it's really, I mean, the amount of, I don't know, straight acting, I don't know quite how to put it, she is just phenomenally expressive without mugging or, you know, it's no Gerard Depardieu or, I've forgotten his name, Daniel Day-Lewis, who I feel is very good at stealing scenes. She's really just naturalistic and just...
Yeah, and often without very little dialogue for long stretches.
Yeah.
She's just sort of by herself, just dealing with her personal tragedy.
Well, yeah, the first thing we see is her attempting to kill herself with...
out of grief.
Yeah, and So visually these films are all heavily influenced by what colour they are, and so this whole film is suffused by blue in the background. It's usually the primary colour, maybe less so in white, maybe more so in red.
I thought this was the most effective use of it because, as we'll soon find out, her husband was a great composer. She was... Well, this is one of those things, but she is at least competent at writing music, whatever the public image is. There is a rumour that she helped him, but nobody seems to take it terribly seriously.
Whenever she is
being inspired, we have these blue flashes across her face, and I think that was that was a very effective use of it. Sorry, do go on.
I was just going to say, we don't really ever know for sure how much she did his work. Was she just sort of a co-author with him, or?
I chose to believe she did it all because it's Juliette Binoche and she's great.
Yeah, I mean, that is plausible. But I like that was, you know, that was held in reserve. And it's open to interpretation.
There have certainly been two.
She's clearly a significant contributor.
Somebody who gave up a musical career in order to marry and then.
Yes, the great man.
Yeah.
And so as we get to know her, she's really. She's an interesting, because she's, in another circumstance, she'd be very, hard to empathize with, because she's very cold and very, but it's absolutely understandable.
This is what I like. You know, her decision, once she's realized that the suicide isn't going to work for her, is to just cut away everything from her own life, go off and live in a small flat in Paris, just be somebody completely different to escape from the, I mean, explicit, but you know, I'm sure there are, you know, 10,000 well-wishers saying, "Oh, I'm so sorry for your loss," and she just wants to get away from everything.
Yeah, yeah.
She just wants to cut herself off from like all human connection because it's too painful.
Yeah.
Well,
the thought of, you know, losing, get some close to someone and lose them again, that'd be too much.
There's a couple of bits that really got to me. One is, when she's back in the empty house and that she kind of hears this and goes and finds the maid sobbing, or the cook, sobbing, and she says, "Why are you crying?" And her response is, "Because you aren't." And that was incredible. And then in the swimming pool, when one of the blue things is that she goes swimming a lot. And at some point it becomes clear that really what she's doing quite often is crying and really letting her emotions out where no one else is there and no one else could possibly be aware of it.
And well, there is a scene where somebody that she knows sees her and she comes out of the pool and she says, "Are you crying?" And she says, no, it's the pool.
And it's all really repressed and buttoned down. So she spends the film... shutting down and trying to cut herself off because I think at some point she says, "I don't want any friends," or it's all a trap. And she's just trying to, and she can't even, her but daughter is barely mentioned at all which I kind of resonates in that she can't even bring herself to think about it in a way. Yeah. It's just.
But it doesn't work though. She tries to cut herself off, but she's not able to do that. Even with the one woman that she really, we might, most think she's justified in hating, the woman who turns out to have been her husband's mistress and who is now pregnant with his child, she can't even hate her eventually.
There's no kind of hate on either side, really. She finds out her husband has betrayed her, but she
and
kind of
apparently
goes...
everybody knew it except her.
She ends up being giving her this immense kind of mansion that they were living in. But not really betraying any kind of emotion. It's such a good performance because she's so cold, but in an absolutely believable way.
I didn't read her as cold at all.
Well, I read her as so afraid of how she would lose it if she gave in to what she was feeling. She had to keep it under control lest she just be completely deranged.
I think, yes, cold perhaps the unfair. Buttoned down. And I think that's why this swimming pool got to me, because it's all there under the surface. She just, as you say, she daren't allow it to come out. It's very good. We have the sort of, did anyone have any feelings or thoughts about the so she has mice moving into her house and then she borrows a cat to eat them all. It felt like that was supposed to be deeply symbolic of something. I'm not sure if I quite meant, or is it just part of the tone?
I can see it as a sort of corner turning, before that she's, "I am content to dwindle down into nothing. Nobody knows who I am," and so on, and just, eventually be found having been dead for 3 weeks and somebody finally breaks into the apartment or something, that sort of thing. None of this is explicit, but that was the sort of feeling I got. And then afterwards she's saying, I need to do this.
I think some of it was, first of all, that was not a mouse. That was a rat. That was huge.
Oh, yeah. Right. You think, it's because I was reading the synopsis to Rhyme Scene, it mentions a mouse.
The subtitles, at least in the editions it that I saw, it says mouse. But that could just be poor translation.
You've reminded me, I thought that at the time.
That's the rat. I think maybe what it was, at least one interpretation, is that she sees that the rat has had babies.
Yeah.
And I think she's moved just by the fact of here's this new little life and... She didn't want to destroy it. I mean, her initial reaction was even after she saw the baby, she went to get a broom.
Yeah.
And you're like, she's gonna kill them. And then she couldn't do it.
Yeah.
I mean, she did eventually, it forced her sort of to talk to her neighbor to borrow the neighbor's cat, which is kind of, I never would have thought to borrow somebody's pet, but okay.
just to eat the mice.
But it was sort of, sort of her process of starting to come back to the world maybe a little bit. She sort of retreated from the world. And the whole movie is really about her starting to feel her way back.
And I guess that's the point of the anti-tragedy, that we start with the absolute apotheosis of horror, and then she slowly realizes you can't just disconnect from the world. She meets the teenage boy who witnessed the accident, who kind of seeks her out. She can't even, so she wants, that's an interesting part where she just wants everything out of her daughter's room destroyed and taken out. But the mobile was left there, the blue mobile, of course. And then she moves that into her own house, her new,
her flat. Like a flat.
It's It's full of little touches like that I think are really, really well done.
I liked in the scene where she meets the teenage hitchhiker who has the necklace that he took from the car accident. There, it looks like they're in the Pompidou Center in Paris, which is, or it's at least it's some big that public style, place, yeah. Like they're in a cafe or something. And while she's talking to him, while she's like pretty much rejecting, like she tells him to keep the necklace and she doesn't want, there's all these people coming in with like these big placards, like they've been at a demonstration. And we never see what's on them. We never, it's just all in the background. We have no idea what it's about. But I felt like, oh, this is like life continuing all around her. This is like big life stuff.
And she knows nothing about it.
And she doesn't want to know.
Yeah.
She just is so closed off. I don't know, something about that scene with the, because there's a lot of it in that scene where she's sitting there talking with the kid. People coming in and they're all gathering behind her. And that's a huge deliberate choice on the part of the filmmaker to have this other stuff going on around her. Because it could have just been, you know, a quiet scene in the little cafe, just the two of them. And it wasn't.
Yeah, well, he had to have these people come in and hold these placards. And
Yeah,
that, for me, it felt like a misstep. This may well be just something about me rather than about the film. I was just slightly disappointed that she ends up going back to something like the conventional life of the widow composer that everybody was telling her she ought to have.
Well, I was about to bring up Olivier and see how we felt about him.
Poor Olivier.
He loved her unrequited, unrequited, unrequited for years. We guess. We think so.
That's the impression.
That seems to be the implication, yeah.
And also, I assume that he knew her husband was cheating on her.
Probably.
I think he
is the person she asks about it, and so he says, well, yes, I knew.
Everybody. Well, and also there's the whole thing where he has the photos of the husband with the lover in with the husband's papers.
That's right, that's how, yes.
And so he took them away so that she wouldn't see them. So yeah, he definitely knew.
So he's kind of looking out for her.
His
lucky day, she calls him over, she sleeps with him, and then she throws him out. It's really like, okay, I'm not Juliette Binoche goddess, I'm merely Julie.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's like, she doesn't treat him very well, but no, I understand the, her motive behind that. You know, she wanted him to not see her as this like romanticized ideal. She says something to him like, yeah, I'm just a woman, you know, I sweat, yeah. I cough and, but obviously that it didn't just deter him. He was still in love with her. Poor guy.
I'm not sure sleeping with a man is the best way to deter them generally, but
probably not.
Something she needed as well at that time. And but it's well done. But then we have this, and I think I'm with Roger. I was a little disappointed the way it kind of panned out, that ultimately what brings her back, I mean, by the end of the film, she's kind of moved a little way towards reconnecting with the world. It's not like she's wankering away through the streets.
But she does give in and help Olivier complete the symphony.
Yes, this unfinished symphony that everyone's talking about, which
she had refused to do
and tried to destroy. But the I don't know what you call it in musical terms, but the person who is in charge of the manuscript had quickly made a copy just in case she destroyed it. And so it is completed, but in doing so, she kind of, it was quite a nice scene where, she rings him and she sort of says, well, are you still into me? Do you still love me? Do you want to come over? And he won't. So it's quite nice that she has to go over to him. He makes her sort of make that. But it didn't, the romance itself didn't quite work for me. I think maybe because we see that. Well, because you never quite, I don't know, she didn't quite sell that she was ready to get into that position to me. But maybe I misread that.
I'm not sure that she was so much thinking about romance with him. She was more thinking about getting the symphony out there.
Right.
And it was his reaction was about getting her to admit that she is a contributor to this, where she had completely denied it before. And I'm not sure that we actually really know if she does admit to it.
No.
That she helped.
Does she agree that that's what she got? You get the impression she probably will.
Yeah. But we don't actually see this. It's not dramatized. We don't know. Like, what is the world's reaction when they discovered that this guy that they thought was such, you know, one of our greatest composers actually had a lot of help with his work?
Yeah, and we don't, yeah. I like that this film leaves a lot to, and sometimes that would irritate me in a film, but it's so well handled here. I think that we have a lot missing.
Yes, she is rejoining the world in a fairly conventional way, but she is still doing it on her own terms. So that is something. I mean, she's choosing when, she's choosing how. She's choosing what she does, even if it is going to end up being the things that perhaps everybody was expecting her to do.
There is a hint, perhaps, that she and Olivier do have a relationship at the end of Red.
Maybe we can revisit, but yes.
Yes, perhaps we should revisit that later.
But they're found together after the events of this.
They are seen together, yes.
Yeah, I mean, Blue was great. I mean, it grips you right from the start, and it's not far off kind of a one-woman show, really, of Juliette Binoche. Yeah. And it's very dialogue light. And it's not without its moments of levity and humour, but it's really well done. So I really enjoyed Blue.
I did too. And arguably, it's Binoche's performance that really makes the film.
I think what made me realise that, if I'm honest, is Red. I didn't get on so well. Well, we'll talk about that later, but I agree with you.
The thing that struck me visually, I mean, there are a lot of gorgeous visual bits, but there's a point at which she has made, let us be generous and say friends, or at least, you know, mutual allies, with her downstairs neighbour, because she was the only one who didn't sign the petition to say that this woman is engaging in prostitution, kick her out of the building. And, you know, they are not good friends, but they are at least friends.
What's another thing that starts to draw her back into the world?
Yeah. But there's a point where that friend, Lucille, calls Julie to come and talk to her at the club where she's working. Yeah, it's that sort of club. That's not what I'm after. The point is, in that shot where they're talking over the table, we have Lucille completely colour saturated. You know, you've got the full flesh tone. It's a very colourful image of her, and then very pale Julie right next to her. And I'm assuming there's a lot of very clever lighting going into making that work, but it does work. So.
Yeah, I mean, and arguably that makes a big contrast between Lucille and Julie, because, you know, they want her out, they want Lucille out because she's a whore, and there's a conversation that she has with Julie in her flat where she talks about how she doesn't want to spend a night alone. Even though she does this quite disreputable work, she's somebody who's really engaging with the world and wants to be around other people. And I mean, the whole, when she calls Julie to the nightclub, it's all about her relationship with her father, and she's quite distressed over this. So even that is like, she's like really engaged with her family,
even
with other
people.
Have
a relationship with her mother who's got Alzheimer's.
That's very
forgotten her, and you sort of get the impression that suits Julie at this point a little bit. That's good. What I really know, Julie is fundamentally a wonderful person. However much she tries to avoid it, she just keeps doing these really kind, nice things. It's not like that, so it's not like a Scrooge story, but I just like that is a kind of theme to it as well.
Yeah.
Other thing that struck me on a technical level, there are several moments often involving blue light where we get snatches of what we gradually realise is the symphony as it's going to end up in various forms. I mean, sometimes it's not its final form. But, you know, I've seen quite a lot of films where Hollywood tries to say, you know, this is a creative person and this is the creative process in action. And all too often it's, you know, his little kid downstairs neighbour says something cute and he realises that that's the thing he needs for his story. But my own experience with writing and songwriting is very much more like that. You know, you suddenly realise that's how it should be. Now let me write this down quick before I forget it.
I really like the bit at the end when she's coordinating with Olivier and they're finishing the symphony, and she keeps saying things like, "Oh, take out the percussion," and or "take out the trumpets," and we're hearing it evolve. Oh, that was really nice, actually.
And this is when the chorus comes in, and then
And there's little bits of that really all through the film. It's like you can, we see her, we hear her imagining, she hears the music in her head, she sits outside, you know, just sitting on the sidewalk, watching the city go by and is inspired by that. Mm. But in not a really obvious way, just, she's just sort of soaking up, she doesn't even realize maybe she's doing it, she's soaking up all the humanity around her. And turning that into this music.
Yeah, however distant she's trying to be, she's taking it. Though yeah. Some nice moments where we get these fade to blacks where it would normally be, and a year later or whatever. But no, yeah. We just fade back in.
It really gets you inside her
mind in a way that she's just kind of shattered and broken and just, that was some good cues. Well, should we move on to De Blanc, to White?
Sorry, I'd just like to say one last thing, because I was very surprised, you know, given the reputation of Kieślowski, deserved or not, as basically a fairly arty director, I found this an extremely accessible film, much more than I was expecting.
Yes, me too.
Well, I think it draws you in at the beginning with this terrible thing, and you want to know more, and that's really the sort of thing that draws you through. I mean, it's not a fast-moving film, but it's not a long film, and fascinating. Mm. So, we move on to Three Colours White. The Equality? I think it's The Equality. I will forget because it's really... So, I guess Blue is... I feel like these have been projected onto it, but Liberty is supposed to be about her finding liberty by cutting all ties from humanity, I think, and realising, no, it's not that great, is it?
Or at least getting out of the way to the tragedy.
Yeah.
So, Equality, Three Colours White, is the story of Carol, a Polish immigrant into Paris, played by Zbigniew Zamowski. Dear me, I'll stick with Carol. And his wife, soon to be ex-wife, Julie Delpy, another Ribbon of Memes alumnus, because we talked to her about a lot with the Before Trilogy. Is that your print?
Yeah, Before Sunrise will be the next year.
Another goddess. Although I have to say, I think it's a little bit disingenuous of the packaging, at least for the DVD that I got, to suggest that she's a main character of this film.
She's not the main character.
She's not.
Sadly,
she's barely in it at all.
She's wonderful in the Before Trilogy, which we liked lots. But here, I was very disappointed with White. So this is the anti-comedy, according to Roger Ebert.
Well, it certainly wasn't funny.
If anti-comedy means not funny, then there are a few moments of physical comedy.
The first thing we see is Carol is obviously uncomfortable in his suit, walking up to the court, and a bird craps on him.
When we come to it, so he is in the process of being divorced. He's so kind of alienated in, I think he's in Paris, certainly in France, that he needs a translator to even argue his case. He doesn't want to get divorced from Julie Delpy's character, Dominique. The reason is that the marriage isn't consummate, so it's not even a divorce. I guess it's an annulment. I'm not sure it's quite clear.
But only if it was done under, for example, the Catholic Church would do that.
Right.
But I don't think there's a provision. It depends on the details of French law, which, frankly, I don't know. It depends on the specific jurisdiction in which they got married.
Yeah, and it is definitely Paris, because that's the same courtroom that Juliette Binoche's character peeks into towards the end of Blue, when she's looking for somebody in the courthouse.
That's right.
And
we get the other side of that shot.
We do. And so Juliette Binoche appears very briefly in White, peeking into the courtroom.
It just made me wish I was watching Blue instead. that's mean. Maybe I did really dislike this one. We'll talk it through and see what
It rapidly becomes clear that this is not just a routine divorce. I mean, A, he doesn't want it and she does, but also, you know, he then goes to the ATM and finds he's got no money and his card's been cancelled.
Yeah. He's got nowhere to sleep, so he goes and sleeps in... Well, presumably it's his wife Dominique's salon or their
salon. I think it's a joint enterprise, which is why he's still got the key. It transpires they are both hairdressers.
And he kind of tries to show that he can actually satisfy her. It doesn't work. So in response, she kind of... I don't know if she's threatening to frame him for burning down the salon or she's actually frames him, but he eventually ends up on the run from the law for arson or suspected arson or attempted arson.
Yeah, I mean, whether or not she actually reported it to the police, he believes that she did. Because he does say later on that he's on the run from the police.
He does, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's quite clear he could get into significant trouble. Whether she's that vindictive or not, we don't.
Her character is so loosely drawn that we don't understand her motives at all.
Yeah.
I mean, that
was the thing that was missing for me. Anyway, I'm not going to deny that there have been horrible vindictive exes in the world, but we never find out why she's doing it. Does she think she is justified, or is she just a sociopath? We can't tell.
If I hadn't watched Blue first, I think this director... Sorry, Marianne.
I was just going to say, like, did he do something to her that we don't get to see? Like, is she somewhat justified in being such a crazy bitch, or...
Well, you feel like you're not. Because I already know, you know, that we've had a great story about a strong, realistic woman, female character, and I found myself searching for reasons, but I didn't really find any. I mean, I just felt like it was a one-dimensional character.
Well, I mean, Carol also ends up, I think, being slightly deranged. And the way the film ends suggests that they're kind of made for each other.
Was apparently shot some months later to try to soften Dominique.
To make her look less like an evil bitch, which is what the rest of the film suggests.
Specifically was.
So then he starts busking. Oh, maybe he's a terrible busker. I don't know how he makes it, but he basically playing the comb very badly. And the moving relationship here, I feel, which is why this, I always think this one's fraternity, because the moving relationship is with another Polish emigre who is in theory much happier. He's got a wife and a family, but he's very sad, and he gives Carol a lot of his time, and they chat and they drink and they basically become friends. And I found that quite moved, that development of relationship. So I quite like that. He agrees to smuggle him back into Poland via a suitcase. Another indication that it's a 90s film. I don't even know if he could have got away with that in the 90s. I don't know.
It does seem unlikely. Didn't they have like overweight baggage rules in the 90s? I'm sure they must have.
Also potential for quite serious medical complications with a combination of low oxygen and not being able to move.
Exactly.
Hello, thrombosis.
Maybe that's more of the comedy. Yeah. Anti-comedy.
Yes.
Well, we wouldn't know.
Thrombosis is always good for him.
The big case opens and he stumbles out.
Well, that was quite a nice fact.
Because the first thing that happens is he gets stolen by Polish criminals, and that they open up the case hoping, because it's obviously heavy, it must be valuable. Oh, it's just this guy. Beat him up and leave him for dead.
And then he jumps up and goes, "Yeah, Jesus, I'm home."
That's more comedy. He's like literally dumped in this like slag pit, and he's like, "Yeah, I'm home."
In this like road style wasteland.
Horrible, yeah.
I think it could have been played for more laughs, but that was a funny bit. I'll grant you that. And then, the other bit I thought was almost physical comedy is when he finds his brother, returns to hairdressing, and he's like amazing at hairdressing. So everyone wants him to, his brother wants him to come back to hairdressing. But he dabbles in low level crime with a petty warlord. And the bit where he's the guard and he has to look sort of inconspicuous, that bit of physical comedy almost worked for me. He's trying to work out what kind of body language am I supposed to have here?
He's clearly.
I'm going to drop it. Oh crap.
He's Carol is sort of cast as a sort of, bit of a sad sack character, a bit inept, thinks he's smarter than he is, and gets in trouble when it doesn't work out the way that he hopes, but in the end, actually, he turns out to be better.
He
just learns how to be a better criminal.
He uses the information he gathered to buy up some land that, was it IKEA are going to buy?
And some other company. Yeah, they were going to build warehouses or something.
IKEA was the one that stuck in my mind for some
Me
reason.
Me too, yeah.
And then we get this kind of rags to riches story where he starts with almost nothing and becomes this kind of... this may be lost in you, Marianne, but this Del Boy in Only Fools and Horses kind of style yuppie character.
Yeah.
Suddenly turns into this slicked back hair, hard-nosed businessman. And I didn't have... I liked Carol more. You know, we all like the underdog, so you kind of like him a bit as a sad sack. When he gets to that level...
He has stereotypically Polish faces, which are very impressive when they're being sad, to me at least.
Yes.
Face like a dumpling.
Though we did, again, further development of his relationship with his friend, who's like, okay, I've got a very sad friend who wants to be killed.
I mean, he must be a bit dim because it was completely obvious.
It was pretty obvious, right, from the moment
Nikolai
he said,
was talking about himself.
Yeah, I've got this very sad friend
who wants to die.
But that, in a way, that moment when he gives... Is it Nikolai? Sorry.
Nikolai.
Nikolai.
M for some, yeah.
For Polish reasons. Where he kind of shoots him but doesn't, because that was a blank. I will say, don't shoot someone with a blank, even because
that would have probably killed him anyway. Oh, yeah, it was really a blank. Yeah.
At the very least, it would
even a blank.
Lots of skin tearing and tissue damage. Yeah.
So don't do that.
But suspension of disbelief.
That scene, although that was the relationship I was more invested in, it didn't quite work for me. I wasn't quite convinced by, I don't know, the way Carol kind of turns around. But anyway, he pretends to kill him and then says, ha-ha, okay, the next one I will kill you. Because I suppose Carol isn't really a killer when it comes to it.
He's not.
Well, also, he likes the guy.
Yeah. But that scene after that where his friend, who's been this kind of morose, is rediscovering the joy of life. I genuinely, that was a bit heartwarming to me, where he's doing snow angels and I liked that bit. But then we have this, it turned out it was all a sort of elaborate revenge plot. I'm not sure when the revenge plot was hatched or whatever, but it is a way, it's all a way to get back at Dominique, because he can then, the only way he can attract her from Paris, I think, is by being rich and famous now. Mm. And so she comes over, and now she's really into him.
Well, no, he dies first, and she comes to the funeral.
Oh, God, I've forgotten the whole death.
he basically fakes his own death.
Yeah.
And he has rewritten his will to leave everything to his ex. So it's
he
all
can
this
watch
big...
her kind of cry at the funeral.
Yeah. That's well, nice. I think he's waiting to see if she does cry.
Right, yes.
And then she does, and he's like, oh, yeah, she's definitely still into me.
Yeah, gotcha.
And then they go, and then, yeah, she's in his hotel room. He's in her hotel room when she comes back from the funeral, and they have sex.
I mean,
so it's like, oh, yeah, this is what it takes for him to get it up and for her to get into him. And it's like, what?
I mean, I could, if it had been a better drawn, I mean, I do, you know, there are messed up relationships in the world,
oh, sure.
And there are people who get off with this kind of
absolutely.
Stuff.
Absolutely, but we don't see enough of their relationship.
We don't see any of that. Your natural reaction to, haha, I'm not dead after all, would be to kick him in the balls, not get to bed with it.
Yes.
I would have thought. So it really lost me at that point, and you lose kind of any, well, you lose kind of any, or I lost any respect for him for doing it, and for her for being like, oh, actually, that turns me on a bit. It just totally lost me at that point.
And then it turns out
that she's he's framed her for his murder.
Yeah, so he's not even like it's. No, it wasn't even a plan to get her back. It was a plan to get her in prison.
Yeah,
which
it's a pretty fragmentary case. I've got to say.
it's not a watertight plan, is it?
No,
it feels a bit like a. In a way, it's like an anti-farce rather than anti-comedy, and that it's kind of all farcical stuff, but played...
It's farcical stuff, but it's played straight.
Yeah.
Well, and the thing that really struck me toward, in the last section in particular, when he'd been, being the big businessman and then setting up the murder and so on, it's not an anti-comedy, it's an anti-caper.
Yeah, there is a caper.
I could picture somebody like the Mission Impossible team doing that sort of setup, so that here is this important guy who has been murdered, and you are in the frame for it because you're the bad guy of the week. That kind of thing. But
instead,
again,
he's doing it to Julie Delpy, which is.
but also.
But doing it because he loves her so much.
Loves her so much that she ends up in prison, and she's so annoyed by this that she wants to marry him again.
But we've seen capers where, leading man, leading lady are doing that whole dangerous flirting and I'm getting you into trouble, but I know you can get yourself out and you're getting me into trouble, but I can get myself, that kind of I mean, frankly, not particularly real-worldish relationship, but it's something we've seen, it's something that could work on this, but we don't get that either.
No.
Well, I even think, as you said, Mary, I think you could construct a relationship that works along those lines of people react,
sure.
Because people are weird. We're all weird and we all like it. But yeah. We're not given any contact, we're not given any suspicion that they'd be into. I mean, it's almost like a Mr. and Mrs. Smith. I tell you, a bit like War of the Roses, where they love each other, but they just kill each other and damage each other the whole time. But it's never really, we barely see Dominique through the whole film.
Yeah, she's hardly in it.
And so
I wonder if there's an implication when, so the last shot of the film is he goes to see her in prison and sees her in the window of her cell, presumably several floors up, you know, and the light is on, it's night outside. And it's sort of an echo of, much earlier in the film, he's been sort of hiding out in the metro station, sleeping there. And he takes Mikolai up and points out, like, look, there she is. There she is in her flat, you know, getting ready to go to sleep. And Mikolai is like, is that what you think? She's getting ready to go to bed, huh?
Yeah.
Like, she's by herself, huh? So I wonder if the implication is that now Carol has her someplace where he knows exactly who she's with and not with, and he's got a bit of control over her. But he can go and see her whenever he wants.
I think you're right.
I'm not sure that you
visually,
know...
Visually, there is an echo of that. And we know from the other films that, you know, he deliberately does that in a lot of things.
Yeah.
But that's... The implications of that are quite disturbing. I mean,
yeah.
I don't know what we're supposed to... I mean, we find out later somehow, unless, I don't know, they're both out of prison and together again, maybe, possibly, I don't know quite how that fits in with the time.
I guess, or maybe... He helped her escape from prison. They went on an actual caper.
They did an actual caper.
Because what happened to all his money? I mean, do you still inherit money if you commit murder? Probably not.
So he's lost all of his money. She hasn't got it all. It just seems like such a bizarre... He's now got to spend, just to get this moment of revenge, he's now got to spend the rest of his life on the run. It just seems a very...
I don't know. It could be a
tragedy. But that tragedy would show him at the end, you know, I'm free, I've got my revenge, and what does it get me? It gets me nothing. But there isn't a scene like that either.
No.
didn't work for me. I was really disappointed because I really enjoyed Blue. And then I was like, oh, girl.
Yeah.
But that does seem to be the general opinion, not everyone's opinion, but the general opinion that White is the weakest of the three. Certainly that's our opinion.
Yeah, for sure.
Mm.
So, Rouge, somehow White is equality, which I think is like a twisted form of equality that...
So revenge is equality?
Don't know. It's all a bit...
Or they're equally screwed up.
Yes, they're equally screwed up, yeah. Red is the fraternity film, I guess, if we're going off that. I'm increasingly feeling that it's a bit pointless describing them in those terms. But this one felt the most strongly coloured, can I say that, to the point where I was slightly distracted by how much red there was on the screen. I think Blue did it more subtle. White...
Well, Blue used it for specific instances.
Yes.
So. Yeah.
And Red is... All the time, all around, every frame has got some red in it, I feel. It felt like he doubled down on the colour thing.
Mm.
But it's a very different story. So in this, we have Irina Jacob?
Valentina
is the character's name.
Yes.
Irina Jacob, yeah.
And... I'm going to be... I found this one confusing from the off. So this is the anti-romance of Roger Ebert's description. So we start... it starts with a telephone call, and then we see how calls are connected, and they get this kind of matrix-esque
sequence.
Probably
more unusual in 94 before everybody knew about the internet, to be fair.
Yeah.
But this was a long-distance call, it turns out. But already I was a little... confused, because then we have these two intertwining, well, not really intertwining narratives, but one of them's very dominant. So this is the story of Valentina, who is we find out later a student, I think, or I missed it if we found out earlier, but it's right at the end.
Mostly she's a model, isn't she? I mean, that's
who does And she has a boyfriend in England who is an absolute dick, as far as you can tell quite quickly. He's very controlling and...
And yet she constantly wants to please him. He only appears on the phone, but yeah, she talks to him quite frequently and, yeah.
And again, well, these are relationships that exist, and there are situations people find themselves in. But then we have this other character who kept cropping up that honestly I didn't quite understand who they were or what was going on, which is this law student, Augustine? Is he Augustine in the film?
August, I think just Luna. August, yeah.
August, sorry.
Slightly more law student. He's taking his exams to become a juge.
So he's already French equivalent of a barrister, I guess.
And he lives across the street from Valentina.
Yes.
Like, they don't interact, but we see...
his big red car.
He sees her from his flat window and vice versa, yes, and they see each other's cars. Like I said, they're sort of just passing in the night. They're neighbors who don't seem to know each other.
Well, so I read this was supposed to... and I say I read because it didn't come across to me. Maybe it did here, that we were supposed to be... kind of right from the start, oh, when will these two get together? When will this romance happen? But I wasn't thinking that, I'm afraid. I was just a little confused as to why we had this other story going on.
I wasn't thinking that, but as things went on, the impression I got, and I haven't read around this one particularly, shall we go into the characters a bit? Because I think it helps to know who the characters are. She is driving home one night and she fails to pay attention and hits a dog. Which I'm glad to say is not shown. The dog is not
nothing
killed.
Gratuitous in these films. There's no gratuitous sex scenes really either, which I appreciate.
But she works out where it must have come from. Takes it to the guy who doesn't seem to care. Then goes on and takes the dog to a vet, and so on.
Always nice to see a vet in a film.
And gradually she keeps visiting this guy. They have this frankly spiky, but sort of friendship. And I think it's the sort of friendship that you get from people who have absolutely no crossover in their world. So, you know, A doesn't need to worry about B talking to A's friends about it because they're just never going to meet.
But so this is the judge,
Kern.
A retired judge,
Jean-Louis Trintignant.
Yeah,
thank you, Roger. I thought he was very good in it, actually. I really liked his performance as a... he's a grumpy old white guy.
A slightly Clint Eastwood rugged look. I don't know if that's usual for him.
I think he was...
But certainly I could picture Clint Eastwood of about this era playing him in the remake.
I can see that.
I feel like I single him out as, oh, I really liked his performance, because I wasn't particularly blown away by Irina Jakov. She's got Juliette Binoche to compare to, but I just felt it's much harder to quite understand. She looks very pretty. She has a significant
career, but she's not a big international star like the other two leading ladies we've had.
No, yeah. And perhaps I'm being unfair to her there, but I wasn't blown away by her acting as I was with Juliet. But anyway.
I was not either. She doesn't give Valentina an awful lot of depth. Mm. She seems very much on the surface.
Well, yeah,
much dialogue. And maybe that's what Valentina is. Some people are like that.
Yes, but you don't... But again, it's unfair to compare it to Julie in the first film, but she gets very little dialogue, you know very little about her, but you want to know more.
Exactly.
And you're sort of hanging on her every expression. Yeah. I kind of wasn't here.
Yeah.
Mm.
I feel like Valentina does some things that are maybe a little bit enigmatic or questionable, but it doesn't make you wonder why she's doing them, you just think, this doesn't make sense.
Hmm. Mm. Oh, and you can't kind of explain it, just kind of...
Exactly.
You feel that, you
like,
know,
there's not a lot of room for, like, interpretation or... she doesn't invite much sympathy. Not sympathy.
I said, no, you
she's
don't.
Just, I mean, she's just, yeah. She's, I mean, I found the retired judge guy to be quite creepy. He changes as the film goes on.
Yes,
but I really wondered why she kept going back there, because I was getting serial killer vibes off that guy.
Well, he is creepy.
And you would think,
it turns out she's right to go back because he's not as creepy as he seemed. But from what we see, I agree, he's...
And indeed, one of the first things she learns about him is he's been eavesdropping on his neighbour's phone calls.
Yeah, exactly. He's doing the lives of others, job, isn't he? Phones.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she's outraged and offended, but also he doesn't give a crap about his dog, which doesn't endear him to me.
See, that alone would be reason enough to stay away from him.
Yeah.
Here's
yeah.
his dog is hurt, and turns out the dog is also pregnant, and he's like, yeah, whatever.
I don't care.
You could take the dog.
But then we find out later on that Augustine has a similar attitude to his pet, and yet we're supposed to feel he's a potential romantic partner. I didn't like Augustine much, but maybe I was too coloured by the fact of him tying his dog to a lamppost and driving off.
That was terrible.
And so obviously and yet he does come again by the end of the film.
He does. He obviously has a change of heart and goes back and gets it. But still,
But in any case, Valentine says you should confess this. You should, not just you should stop doing it, but you should admit what you've been doing. One of the bits they overhear is one of the neighbours, a married neighbour talking to his male lover, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and she storms over to reveal it all, and then she realises his daughter knows it anyway, and then she sort of then becomes complicit in the listening, because she can't bring herself to report it. So that was a nice touch,
because he has presumably been so impressed by her force of personality.
She's very pretty. Well, I think that, in a way, I just feel like, oh, she's a pretty woman, so he's... I didn't feel like there was any other reason for him to get...
Well, she doesn't really have much personality beyond this, beyond what we see, I think. I agree.
No, she doesn't. You don't get... You just don't get sense of much depth in her.
No.
And I felt like the film really... I think it suffers from things that feel like a lot of too much coincidence.
Well,
like, neighbor, August, or whoever, he... is having an affair with one of the neighbors that the retired judge has been listening in on. And somehow that, when the news of what the judge has been doing, that he's been eavesdropping, gets out, that causes their relationship to break up?
I only know this from reading on Wikipedia, because I'm going to admit I read a lot of plot summaries because I was confused. But in the court case with the judge... his girlfriend then meets someone else during the court case somehow at the courthouse, and that's how she ends up cheating on August.
But earlier there's the implication when Valentina and the retired judge, they were listening to one of the phone calls between August and she, you know, Valentina's like, oh, I just hear two people who are in love. And I would agree that their conversation that we overhear does sound like these two people who are really into each other. So, but then all of a sudden she like randomly meets some of the guy, and
well,
that's it, she's done?
The judge, whom I think we're supposed to assume is something of a student of human nature, is contradicting that. He's saying, no, she's bored with him already, they'll be splitting up soon, even at that
that's
early
true.
Stage.
He's got some kind of Sherlock Holmes kind of character in that he deduces that her brother is a crack addict or a morphine, I forget his drug, and that because of the way she reacts to this drug dealer... But it's not. I'm glad you both found it confusing, because I did. I didn't really quite understand a lot of at this point.
There is a key thing which I promise I'll get to. But anyway, August tries to phone Karen. She doesn't answer the phone. He eventually climbs up to her flat and sees her in bed with another guy. And that's when he abandons the dog, because that's just how sad he is.
Because he's sad. But I didn't. I didn't really care, because I didn't know who this was. Well, I didn't really understand why I was...
So the way I see it, and particularly we get this when Kern is ultimately talking about himself, which he's reluctant to talk about his past, but eventually he had a lover who betrayed him and then went to England and died in an accident.
Well, like Marianne, I wasn't sure quite what the point of these weird
August
coincidences
is Kern.
Was.
Kern is August.
Well, yeah, but
yeah.
What is that literally, or is this? Oh,
this
exactly.
is
where
the this
similar...
is the first thing that I would call arty film that we've had out of this. I mean, I'm not saying the rest are bad.
Yeah.
I think the rest are good, but this is the first thing where it's clearly this is not just reality, this is something a bit weird going on.
This is fairy tale, because we have these odd mirrors of like, oh, a book fell open at a certain page and I studied it and I passed my judge exam, which is exactly what happens to August. And we find out at some point that Valentine also hit her boyfriend's dog with a car, and that's how they met. I mean, she probably needs to get some glasses or something.
But just pay attention. Stop fiddling with the radio when you're driving.
Yeah, exactly.
I was starting to get the sense because of like Kern, that the retired judge seemed to have knowledge of stuff that he couldn't possibly know. Like he talks to Valentina about, oh yes, you're going to be with this guy in 20 or 25 years, and you're going to be happily and married and whatever. I was like, is he supposed to be like God?
Yeah.
Is this whole thing with, you know, eavesdropping on his neighbors, is this like a creepy, like, you know, God can see you all the time and knows what you're doing, that kind of thing?
Well, I was getting vaguely, I was like, is this a science fiction? Or does he mirror back on himself?
Yeah. And then, of course, then at the very end, and of course he encourages Valentina. She tells him that she's going to England to visit her boyfriend. And I think she says she's going to fly, and he's like, oh no, you should take the ferry.
Yeah.
The ferry would be cool.
Well, yeah, well, that would be good, wouldn't it?
And then at the very end, when the ferry has sunk and the only survivors of the ferry are all the main characters from these three films, that was when I realized, like, oh, so this is, he's God. He is engineering all this stuff and he knows what's going to happen. And that's just ridiculous.
I haven't got that much patience for, I mean, I am not a Mulholland Drive fan. I don't like these very open kind of, oh, it's a bit like a dream. Or I'd rather there was a concrete reality. Now, that's probably more my personality.
That is more my thing as well. Or I can take a dream thing if it's at least consistent as a dream thing, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I don't need everything to be like super concrete. I don't need everything spelled out. A bit of ambiguity is fine.
As we like, but in Blue, a lot of these ambiguities that we enjoy filling in.
But sometimes things are so ambiguous, so loose, that it just feels like there's not a lot of thought behind it. You want to feel like, even sometimes, even with movies where you're like, wow, I didn't really get that, but you still get the vibe. There's like a vibe there and you're like, there's something going on here, I got to figure it out. And sometimes, as with this film, you're like, that's what I'm saying. No, I don't, this is not that kind of film.
Yeah. Well,
this is the kind of film where you're like, nobody really gave it the thought. This is the first draft of the script and it needed some work.
I feel like it's, you know, whenever you put something enigmatic, then people can read into that something much cleverer than you thought of in the first place, which is half the thing. I wonder why people do enigmatic. But I don't, as you said, these coincidences, it's not how real life works. So you're making up this world where these weird coincidences happen and you're like, oh, what about that? Mm. But I'm not interested because that doesn't tell me anything about reality. Because that's
exactly
weird coincidences happen in reality, but
but they're
kind of meaningless.
Reality doesn't have to make sense. It can be full of coincidences, but that's not how fiction works.
And so if you're saying, oh, what do you think about it? Then I think, nothing, it's a coincidence. Am I supposed to think, you've obviously written it this way? Well, my classic example of a film that is confusing, but I really want to understand it, is Primer, the time travel film, where I really want to, it's confusing, but I think in some ways maybe more deliberately confusing than it needs to be, but
you get a sense that there is some cohesion behind
there's a reality there, and the fact that all the characters are confused and nobody knows what's going, well, that's how time travel probably would work. But here it's like, I feel like there's some kind of beard stroking kind of, and how do you feel about this? This is confusing, isn't it? This is interesting. And I don't find it interesting because it's not how the world works.
I think when a film like this is, when it, you kind of come out of it feeling a bit unsatisfied and like it doesn't quite make sense, you don't get a sense of what the storyteller's trying to say.
No, well, I think that's it. It just feels like, much as I felt with Mulholland Drive, there isn't really anything that these foundations rest on. And you can say, oh, well, I was trying to stimulate debate and thought. Yeah. But
debate about what?
In a way, it's a bit like reading a 5-year-old story where it's nonsensical.
That happens.
Yeah, if you're trying to hold a mirror up
because
to reality.
It happened. Yeah.
Yeah, there's no... Anyway, so...
Yeah.
Perhaps I'm being a bit harsher. I certainly preferred red to white.
One of my notes on this is just the phrase, deeply symbolic dead battery. So...
We should. Yes. We have not mentioned the old woman trying to dispose of a wine bottle in a glass disposal. What do you call
that? That was a recurring motif, and it wasn't just an old woman. There was an old woman for sure in the first film. And there was an old woman in the third film, but it was an old man in the second film.
Oh, was it? I missed it.
Because I was really paying attention.
Well,
but
can't
you can
have been
sort
the same
of
person because he was in Poland, wasn't he?
Yeah. There is a whole running motif through all three films of broken glass.
Yes.
I don't know what it means, but I kept noticing that. There's broken windows. There's little broken drinking glasses. There's the broken glass of the bottles being recycled.
See, whenever we come to this sort of, the famous fictional author Garth Marenghi always comes to mind for me, which is, I know writers use subtext and they're all cowards, which I have little, much like Tolkien, I don't have a lot of patience for that kind of allegory. Sometimes it works really well and some stories do it almost without you noticing or they stay with you and you want to invent, like Blue. Yep. I would say Blue is a good example of that, that you feel like there's hidden depths and there's more you want to understand and you care about them.
Yeah.
And that
Pan's Labyrinth a bit to that extent as well.
But it works because it's kind of internally consistent. And here, I wouldn't say that I didn't care about this. I did kind of enjoy their, but I agree the judge is creepy and it's weird, but I sort of enjoyed their, but, and I was starting to become interested in what was happening, but it pretty quickly you realise, well, it's not going to be explained. It's just going to be question mark.
I think the, Roger, what you were saying about, like, is it real or is it not? In movies where that all works, it doesn't matter whether it's real or not, because whatever the story is, makes you feel, makes you think, is valid in either case. But when you spend the whole movie thinking, wait, is this real or is it not? And that's it? That's not enough.
That's not by itself enough.
No.
I think if one wanted to build a romance out of it, one might say something about, well, you know, Auguste and Valentine are both being rescued from the ferry disaster at the end. And, you know, everybody else we see is already hooked up with somebody else.
I think that is meant to be the implication at the end. And
they
I have to say too,
meet.
Yeah, and the very beginning of the film where we see how they live across from each other, and they could, you know, they are conceivably crossing paths on the regular without meeting. In the very beginning, I thought, oh yeah, these two are going to get together. And then it didn't seem like that was going to be happening, so I totally forgot about that.
Well, I think that is the idea. The problem, I actively disliked August, so he got rid of his dog. He was, it's the kind of, I mean, not only was he being betrayed, but he kind of clambers up in a hotel room and spies on his, it all felt like unpleasant.
Yeah.
He takes the dog
masculine behaviour.
But he doesn't rescue the dog from the ferry disaster.
Well, they don't mention whether the dog's safe or not, but probably
it's not.
Well, you would think that he would have been holding the dog though at the very end. Probably.
It would have been down on those ferries. It would have been down in the car. Oh, dear.
I hadn't thought about that.
That's terrible.
I did find myself thinking, cross-channel ferry disaster. That's ridiculous. Well,
oh wait, that is.
I mean, that was not due to weather, but even so.
Yeah. It also felt, you know, a bit like the end when it is all our main characters. I don't know, that felt a bit gimmicky to me. I wasn't really sure what. Oh, here they all are. Okay. But I wasn't sure what to make of that. So, as you said, the logical conclusion, I guess, is that the judge is some kind of powerful entity or god who has somehow engineered all this, but that's not a satisfying conclusion anyway.
It's not.
Then again, there's a bit earlier where they're talking. He's talking with Valentine about, you know, what I'm doing isn't so bad, and it all felt kind of a philosophy student argument. Well, you know, you're doing this good thing. Who are you doing it for? You're selfish, really. That kind of thing.
Which
argues against him as some kind of supreme being, because it's a very stupid argument.
Well, I mean, maybe the point the film is making is that God is just a creepy old bastard who's just toying with us. And
well, look at the world. Maybe that's true.
I mean, I don't believe in any God, but if I did, that's what I would think about him.
Some of that worked for me when he's saying, and I came to realise that judging people is an act of sort of vanity on him. And that scene kind of worked. It would have worked a lot better if I sort of liked the characters more. But I liked his explanation. But even then it felt a bit trite, like, oh, this man was guilty, but I let him go. And now he's got a family and he's happy. And she's like, oh, maybe you should let them all go. And I'm not a particularly right way, but I don't know that that's a, I don't know that that's a very simple argument. I agree.
Well, it wasn't making much of an argument, really.
No.
That's the thing. It just sort of, just another anecdote thrown in there that doesn't seem to connect up with the rest of what's going on.
Fair enough, it was a lot more. He has burned out, which is entirely reasonable. It's a thing he might well do, but it doesn't go anywhere from there. So.
Well, we also have in this motif people talking to each other on different levels. In the, you know, when they're in the theatre at the end after the show, he's like, she's looking down on him and he's looking down at him, and then we have him August spying on his girlfriend from below, and there's a lot of this people talking on different levels. Mm. I don't really know. I mean, that was an interesting visual motif, I guess. And I liked a fair bit of Red. I liked the bit where he's talking about, it's purely visual thing, but when he's talking about the book falling and we as the camera sort of fall down into the pit like the book did, which I thought was nice.
Yeah, and in the end I felt that Blue was the one that made the best use of, we are having a bit of blue, and this is actually significant, rather than just there is a whole lot of blue on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it feels like when you think back on Blue, you do get a kind of bluey feeling from the kind of thing. When I think back on Red, it's just like, it's all red all the time. Red. It's a red car. She's red. I did like the kind of visual connection between her poster and then at the end when she's coming off the ferry, shivering in the blanket. It was the same shot, which was nice. Again, I don't know that it was profound, but it was pleasingly circular from a purely visual perspective.
They are all visually pleasing, even with the white, and you know, here is the bleak vista of Poland. It's still good to look at.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, do we have anything to draw? Now, we've talked about all the three films individually, but do we have anything to draw them all together, particularly, or are we done with talking about?
Well. Possibly worth mentioning that Kieslowski did say these were his last films. These, and there was one, I think, The Double Life of Veronique, that came out just before these, that were his big international successes.
And he did die not long after these films.
Yeah, he said at the end of this he was going to retire, and then 2 years later he died. So.
Yeah, I mean, he's a great filmer. I loved one of these films. I think I actively disliked White. I think I did. And Red, I found confusing. Mm. I enjoyed bits of it, a lot of it. So,
In retrospect, I would like to watch them for the first time in the reverse order, except for
the last scene. You would like that tacked on at the end of Blue. Again, arbitrarily say whether we think these films are masterpieces or not. For me, Blue, absolutely. I think that was a masterpiece. And in a way, it's everything I thought I might be missing from watching more genre films, which is it. Which
that's
is
really, for
do.
Me, Blue is the only one that sort of held up to the reputation of these films.
Mm. Yeah. Whereas, White, I don't, it's a bit like when a non science fiction writer writes a science fiction novel and thinks they're saying the most profound things. To me, this felt like a non-comedy director writing a comedy and thinking, oh, this is funny, and it's just... And it was disturbing and disappointing in the way that he handled the women in it compared to how he handled Blue. Mm. And Red, almost well. I could see a film like that working, but it didn't work for me.
A different version of that film.
Yeah, yeah. And I feel like I've been a bit mean on Irina Jacob, but she's very good in it, but I feel like her whole role is to look pretty, which she is, and she did very well. So.
Yeah.
Red is trying to be a masterpiece, I could argue, and White isn't really trying. But that was my impression.
That's very generous. I feel like it was trying.
The thing that really surprises me, I mean, these are films made, I don't know what the shooting schedule was like, but pretty clearly more or less back to back. Mm. By a director who pretty much knew what he wanted to do. He was born in 1944. He went to the film school in Lodz. He's been directing for 30 years at this point. And I don't get a feeling of a specific personal style out of it, except in a very broad way.
Mm. Yeah, I'm trying to think. Well, it was interesting what they said, should we try and connect them all? But there is, tonally, the red and blue are sort of similar. White is a different kind of... Yeah. But then, you know, that's good in a way that the director produces lots of different styles of film, like John Carpenter. You know,
good on him for getting enough funding to do three films and just said, yeah, okay, I can make it French, sure.
Yeah. This one's Liberty. This one's... Yeah. And this one, again, Fraternity. Oh, I don't know. She strikes up a weird friendship with the creepy judge.
Well, there's the cliche of, you know, the author who's written five books versus the author who's written the same book five times. So.
Yeah.
I'll go with the former, and that's what Kieslowski's doing. I mean, yeah. I was expecting it to be more arty, and then blue and white lulled me into a false sense of security.
So what do you think arty is, Roger? I'm just interested, because I agree with you, just from what you were expecting from an arty film.
I think it is... Well, first of all, that valuing the visual impression over plot and character and stuff.
Right.
Which we... When we back in the day when we talked about Paris, Texas, that was the one that really put me onto that.
Yeah.
I could watch that.
That's a very pretty film. Day. Yeah.
But also, you know, we don't mind if the dramatic unities are fractured a bit. We don't mind if, you know, this bit of time and that bit of time don't quite match up, or we see them on screen at the same time, all that sort of thing, because it's making a point. And when I use arty dismissively, it's because it's trying to do that, but it's not actually making a point. And I don't know. You know, maybe we're just not smart enough to get the subtle implications of it. But I've met a lot of situations like that, and a lot of the time, the person doing it just doesn't really know what they're saying anyway. So.
Well, yeah. I sometimes, rather meanly, I sometimes wonder how much there's an element of Emperor's New Clothes with some films like this.
Yeah.
By this, I mean red. White, I don't. But blue, yeah. I mean, he is. If he made one film like Blue, which he did, it's Blue, then I'm very happy with him as a human and as a director. So as a trilogy... didn't work for me as a trilogy, but I don't want to be down because Blue is brilliant, and in no way did it less my opinion of Juliette Binoche, which was already
what could
well
not much well, nothing I've, that I've encountered.
Well, let's hope it never does.
Exactly. And,
with that in mind, I guess we'll draw the tricolour to the... I've been listening to stories about the French Revolution. The tricolour is not something that was forged in unity and friendship and all that. Anyway, that's by the by.
We start singing about impure blood and how it's going to be spilled on the streets.
let's move away from that. Thank you very much, Marianne, for joining us in this bumper episode of...
pleasure to be here. Thank you. Yeah,
pleasure. Well, hopefully we shall see you again as we move further
on. Absolutely.
Cheerio, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye.